TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Azmi Bashara, Palestinian Israeli. Keynote speech on Iraq and Palestine. Part 1. Azmi Bashara speaks three languages and received a PhD in philosophy from Humboldt University Berlin in Germany. Elected three times after initially running in 1996, he holds a seat in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. He was a guest of honor at the annual banquet of the San Francisco chapter of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, co-sponsored by the University of California, Berkeley. Azmi Bashara was introduced by the internationally known Palestinian-American journalist Lami Sandoni. Her brief speech is so full of warmth and passion and information that I thought you should hear it, even though she stood too closely to the microphone and a few distortions ended up on the tape. Here is Lami Sandoni, colleague and close friend of Azmi Bashara.
It's in trying times like these, in the bleakness and the pain and agony of war, that we need to go back to our universal values, to take strength and to restore our faith in humanity. It's in times like these, when words have been stripped of their meanings, when concepts have been emptied of their content, that we need clarity. Azmi Bashara is the voice of clarity, not just in Palestine and Israel, but of a voice of clarity in the world. In a time of paradox, you need people who understand the fundamental nature of a universal humanity and cut through all of the jingoism, all of the propaganda, and seek truth in humanity. And Azmi Bashara has been challenged as a Palestinian with an Israeli citizenship with such a paradox. He's challenged as a humanist and a citizen of the world, being in a country where it's the country of his birth, the country of his ancestors, but he's treated not only as a guest, but as an unwelcome guest, as a nuisance, to say the least. I'm not surprised, reading his biography and knowing him, that he studied philosophy. Azmi Bashara was born in Nazareth in 1956. He got his PhD from Germany, and then he went back to Palestine, where he was the head, the chairman of the philosophy department. His credentials are many. In 1996, Azmi Bashara decided to run for the Knesset. He didn't run for the Knesset just because he believes in representation, but because he has concluded that the only solution to this paradox of Israel, Palestine, Arab, have to involve recognition of the humanity and rights of all. Pan-Arabism cannot be eliminated to make place for Israel. Palestinian identity cannot be destroyed in order to make state for the other. This is the third time that Azmi Bashara last year won in the elections, and he's still in the Knesset. As a result, the Israeli establishment moved against him. Last year, in May 2001, Israel invoked colonial laws of 1948 in order to accuse him and to indict him of sedition and supporting terrorism. Azmi Bashara's crime, between quotes, was that he, as a human being, as a philosopher, as a political activist, as a thinker, recognized the legitimacy of the right of the Lebanese and the Palestinians to resist occupation, a right enshrined in the UN National Charter, but dismissed in the current world order as terrorism. Azmi Bshara has always been unequivocal in his opposition to the killing of the civilians, but that didn't matter to the Israeli establishment. Many international intellectuals have voiced their support for Azmi Bshara and for his commitment to world citizenship. He has become a major voice, a leading voice in the Arab world for change based on humanism, freedom, democracy, and independence. I'm very honored to present my friend and the leader and the intellectual, Azmi Bshara.
Thank you for the university and for the chancellor for the auspices of this lecture. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for coming even after the collapse of Baghdad. I think everybody will be not interested anymore to hear anything. The war is over. What are we going to talk about? Well, the fact is that I accepted this invitation before we knew the results of the war, but not only that. We did not oppose the war because of its results. When we opposed the war, we did not know what are the results going to be. We oppose things because they are wrong, not because they're... That's what we do. And the motivations and the reasons for this war are wrong, and they are more important than the results because they are going to stay with us for a while. The means, the motivations, and the reasons for launching this war are going to accompany us as long as the same people are with the same mentality, with the same political culture, are going to stay and run the only superpower in the world. So means and motivations and reasons are still there, and they may be activated in the near future against other countries, and nobody is making a secret about that. So our motivation for opposing the war has nothing to do with the result. I can add something that may surprise some of you. Not only that, I am not sorry for the collapse of Saddam Hussein. I have some reasons to be pleased that he collapsed. Personally, I lost 4 or 5 friends who studied with me in Germany. That they returned home to Iraq, and I never heard about them anymore, what happened to them. People who studied with me in Berlin. Kurds are not Kurds. It's not that we have illusions about these dictatorships, nor about any other dictatorships supported by the United States now in the region. So it's not the issue that we have here a dictatorship and that we are pleased that it collapsed, and we did not have illusions about its sustaining the pressure from the outside. After 13 years of siege in which the state was minimal in Iraq, it was minimized, and technological isolation from the development in the world, and exhaustion of the public and of the army and of the state, and the leadership which is totally disconnected from information because the closest aides of Saddam Hussein do not dare to tell him the truth about his situation. We have no illusions. We had no illusions. Our problem with that war was the fact that the motivations of this war are imperial. It's not even a non-secret. It's something to be proud of today in the United States, to believe that it is an imperial war. It was only a short period of time that people spoke about weapons of mass destruction as something which may threaten the security of the United States. And even in that, only empires can allow themselves so-called preventive wars. You know, preventive war in Nuremberg courts, when some of the officers of Nazi Germany claimed, you know, of course, higher officials, high-ranking officials in Nazi Germany claimed that the war against Russia was a preventive war, because they had to start before Russia, it was considered not only the crime, but the meta-crime, the crime of all crimes by the judges, the fact that you launched the war because you thought, you calculated that it is a possibility that you will be attacked. Preventive wars is a crime against humanity. But this is not only 1946 in Nuremberg. Also here in this country, the traditional right did not believe in preventive wars. And Mrs. Kirkpatrick in the United Nations, in one of the few situations, voted against Israel in 1981 strike against the atom, the nuclear work in Iraq. And Thatcher was for condemning it. This is the classical right that we know in Britain. And only Israel was the only state that stood for what it did in that air raid in Iraq, against Iraq, 1981. The whole difference is that today not only it is not criticized, it's adopted as the paradigm of foreign policy of the United States. This is the difference between the new right and the right, the new conservatives and the conservatives. Some may call it Israelization of American foreign policies. I wouldn't call it like that. Why should I? It's imperial policies. What we witness here is something that have to drive us away a little bit from the classical way of thinking concerning motivations in foreign policies and simplistic economic derivations, which are called sometimes Marxism. No, Marxism, as a social science at least, or as an attempt for social science, as a claim to be a social science, is a little more sophisticated than economic explanations. It's not blood for oil. It's not oil. Oil is within, but it's not only oil. Oil will be bought. I mean, the Iraqis are not going to drink their oil. They're going to sell it anyway. And they're going to sell it to the industrial countries. The Iraqi oil is now used in the United States. It's bought by the United States now, these days. So Iraqi oil will be sold. It will be sold to the industrial centers at the end. And the United States can control the price of oil because it's the biggest consumer and because it has a lot of influence on many OPEC countries. It doesn't have to be militarily in Iraq to control the price of oil. It is militarily in Saudi Arabia. There is a military existence in the Gulf without being in Iraq. There is a military existence in Bahrain in the last 30, 40 years. The Fifth Fleet is in Bahrain. It's the center of the Fifth Fleet. There's a military existence of the United States in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar. They are there. And not to speak about Israel, which the United States is militarily there. It's not being there for oil. And if it is true that you need to be there for oil, you don't need Iraq also to be there. You are there. A question should be asked here anyway. Why do you need to occupy Iraq to make democracy? You are already in Saudi Arabia. Make it a democracy. Anyway. The American army is already in Saudi Arabia. They don't even need to occupy it. They're there. Why don't they make a democracy there? Understand? Anyway, it is not this. It is the decision of turning unipolarity into unilateralism. This is the most important thing. First, they spoke about American primacy. Then we spoke about American unipolarity, that the first Bush, the Bush administration in the first Gulf War did not recognize exactly what it meant that the Soviet Union collapsed. And now they start to understand it as a doctrine. People, 1992, who wrote about it, and who are now in the administration having an opportunity to implement what they wrote at that time, at that administration, already have the time, and they do not speak about oil. They speak about unipolarity of the United States, the fact that the United States should keep being the only power in the world, with no other country, with no other power trying to compete with the United States, neither a nation nor a group of nations. But also putting that in practice as unilateralism. The United States should practice that, should translate that in its actions against other countries should practice hegemony. And the United States should not tie itself to international agreements, no Kyoto, etc., no international court for crimes of war, should not tie itself. Unilateralism should be practiced, not only said in numbers that the United States spends more on military than the 15 states behind it altogether. Something unknown before in the history of states. Unknown before. The United States should practice its hegemony. Change regimes if that is necessary. This is a danger. That's why we think that this war is imperial. And the best field, the best opportunity to practice that was not the so-called liberation of Kuwait. The best field, the best possibility that was given to the United States to practice that was the war against terrorism. The 11th of September and the war against terrorism in general. They gave the best field to practice it because it's ideal. It is total. You have to be preventive because you cannot risk calculating, because it's not a state which is standing on the other side. It's terrorism. You can't calculate what they have to. You have to be preventive the whole time. Unimaginable. I'm going there to change the regime. A regime that needed to be changed like 20 years ago when Rumsfeld was visiting that regime. When he visited Iraq, I'll tell you now a secret that I did not declare it yet, but I will tell you something. Just because I made 20 hours trip, I have to say something that I did not say before. Mr. Rumsfeld not only said about Saddam Hussein, he's a guy that we can't count on, we can count on. The kind of dictators that they needed usually in the third world. This is the guy of people who they usually trusted in Latin America and everywhere else. Since when do they hate dictatorships? Since when is this love for democracy in the third world, in the Arab world, since when? Not only that, but when he visited Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein has already used chemical weapon against Iran and against his own people. He did not say a word against it. 30 years after chemical weapons were used suddenly, he used it only against his own people. And this did not disturb Mr. Rumsfeld from going there and supporting him in the war against Iran. Of course, you know the other story, that they supported him and they sold WAPI to Iran too, the so-called Iran-Contra. You know that. They sold WAPI to find money for supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. All crimes together. And you know that some of the people now in the American administration, very active, were personally involved and convicted in the Congress that they lied about the Contra era. You know, Elliot Abrams is one. But there are others, James Woolsey and others. Douglas Faith, they were involved in the Iran-Contra.
Colin Powell.
They were involved in the Iran-Contra. But Michael Ledeen from Jewish Institute for National Affairs was the envoy of Oliver North to Israel in the Iran-Contra affair. He's not the best spokesman about democracy. At that time, and that's what I'm going to say that was never said before, the relationships between the United States and Saddam Hussein grew so warm that Richard Murphy visited Baghdad and there were only two problems with the Iraqi regime at that time. First, what are you going to do with this big army after the war, which is a good question. They invaded Kuwait with it, and this is a good question. This was a good question. Second, how is your position going to be in the Palestinian issue? I mean, Israel was a problem. And you know what? And here's what I'm going to say. Unbelievable, but it was. Iraq was so, had such a good relationship with the United States that it mediated a meeting undeclared between Richard Murphy and Arafat in Baghdad to discuss possibilities of a settlement before Tunis, before George Shultz, before everything. They had such a good relationship with the United States that they mediated a meeting between the United States and Arafat, a taboo for the United States policies at that time, a secret meeting. In Baghdad, can you imagine? So, of course we don't buy what they say about their sensitivity to democracy, and not only that, that historical experience shows. I have all reasons not to believe now what they call building a democratic Iraq, because I hear the accent. This is not a dialect, this is not an accent, this is not a tone, this is not a language of Democrats. You don't go to a country to build a democracy by splitting the country into three major religions. You don't do that in a democracy. If you want to build democracy in the United States and start saying, for the Catholics we will have representatives, for the Protestants, you are not going to build a democracy in the United States. This is not a language of somebody who's coming to build a democratic nation. First of all, citizenship, universal citizenship, nationality, and inside it, ideological, political divisions, not religious divisions. This is not pluralism. This is a recipe for civil war. Some call it concessional democracy, but I don't think these guys even heard the term. I don't think that's what they are going about. You know, concessional democracy like the Lebanon thing, something similar to Lebanon where communities have relative representation. But this also led to a war in Lebanon, if you remember, 1975, a bloody war, a bloody civil war. You don't build a democracy like that. Knowing, for example, do they know that what are the major parties in Iraq? It's not Ahmed Shalabi. This is not the major party. You know, this is not a major party in Iraq. Probably he has some support in exile among certain people who are around the American administration. I don't know. You can buy him support. Yes, you can buy him support. You can give him now a post in the Iraqi government and give empowerment. Empowerment has now a new interpretation. Yes. You may do that, but you cannot isolate the country from its tradition. Its tradition has, for example, two major Kurdish parties that you could not ignore. They could not ignore because they are pro-American now. And these are not two democratic parties. They are neither liberal nor democratic. Communist Party was the biggest party in the modern history of Iraq. It's not a democratic party. The Ba'ath Party, they are trying to uproot. It's a huge party. It was there before it ruled the country, and it represents some people. Many of the exile activists are Ba'athists, but Ba'athists against Saddam Hussein. London is full of Ba'athists, different waves of conflicts inside the Ba'ath. Most of the people that Saddam Hussein executed in political rivalries inside Iraq were Ba'athist people, were from the Ba'ath, from his own party. What is the United States going to do? I don't think they thought about these terms. That what to do with parties, you know, because democracy, pluralism means parties, ideological parties, not parties that represent certain sects or certain religions or ethnicities. This is not democracy. And we don't believe that they are going to build a democracy because there was no other case in the world history that American military or military of any kind invade another country in order to build a democracy. Democracy had a certain tradition in Germany in the Weimar Republic before even they dreamt about it in the Pentagon. They keep bringing Germany. Germany had its CDU and SPD and all kind, even decadence kinds of democracy, even before they dreamt about it here. And they had the rich experience of the Weimar Republic, 19th century, all kinds of thinking. Many important traditions in the democratic liberal thinking stem from there in general. I'm not speaking about the left and the totalitarian thinking, but also from the democratic thinking. We can speak today about theory of rights in democracy, including roles, without Kant, and without the whole tradition from Kant, and New Kantianism, etc., and the Kantian ethics. But also the CDU, the SPD, etc. No, we don't have such an experience. We don't have it in Latin America. In Latin America, the only tradition that we have is that the United States security apparatus was against democratic experiences until all kinds of dictatorships failed. So we do not believe that it's going to be a democracy. And don't have a bad conscience that you were against the American invasion of Iraq. It's not going to be a democracy. I'm sorry, it's not going to be. If it's going to be a democracy, it's going to be in spite of the American officers, not because of them. It's going to be a struggle.
That was Azmi Bishara, Palestinian Israeli and member of the Israeli Parliament, the Knesset. He spoke in San Francisco on April 12, 2003. Last year, Israel invoked colonial laws of 1948 in order to indict him of sedition and supporting terrorism. There is now an international campaign in his support. This is the first of a two-part speech. In the next broadcast, Azmi Bishara will talk about Palestine. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Azmi Bishara and the campaign in his support on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the full one-hour speech by Azmi Bishara by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.